Welcome to Talk Nerdy. It is Monday, January 25th, and I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria. This week, I want to thank those of you who continue to help me make sure that Talk Nerdy is 100% free to download. So for those of you who visited the website, carasantamaria.com, and clicked on that little PayPal button, I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart. Specifically this week, I want to give a shout out to Lawrence Yulk. I think that's right, Lawrence, and I'm really sorry if I butchered your last name, from Moyne, Illinois. Thank you so very much. Also at the Patreon portal, which you can visit by going to www.patreon.com/talknerdy. I want to thank literally like the hundreds of you that are supporting the show right now, but specifically I want to give a shout out to Phil T-Bear, Timothy Glover, Malcolm Waddy II, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Ken Pfeiffer, Brian Holden, Jeffrey Sewell, and a new supporter, I love this, the Honorable Husband. Yes, that is your name. I love it. Thank you, guys. And again, you know, there's a lot of ways that you can support the show. It does not have to be financially. You can rate and review the show. You can tell your friends about it. Say hi on Twitter, on Facebook. It all helps. I made a weird mouth noise just then. Okay. I want to go ahead and get started. I am actually in Houston, Texas right now shooting for a new television show that I'm going to be involved with. And I'm excited to be back in my home state. Of course, I'm not from Houston. I'm from Dallas. But one of my very, very good friends who I got close to in college lives in Houston. And you are here podcasting with me in Chateau Santa Maria, actually in the Doubletree.
Yes, I know. It's a very fancy hotel.
It is, right.
Downtown Houston.
Mm-hmm. It's safe. It's safe. So, Michael Matthews. I got to say it that way. Michael Matthews.
Of course.
So, I'm so excited. You've never podcasted before.
I have not.
But we learned how to use the microphone, and that's all we really need to know.
Yep, and hopefully I can remember how to use it.
I will remind you, because unfortunately I only traveled with one pair of headphones, so you can't hear yourself. But yeah, I'll whip you into shape. It's cool. So we're here in Houston. I just got off of a long shoot. It's Saturday, so you did not work today, but I'm excited to talk to you about your chosen field because we both were studying neuroscience at the University of North Texas together. We were in the same neuroscience lab.
Right.
So when I was there, I was working in cell culture. You were in the robot room, right?
Yes, we had this archaic robot that instructions were lost many years ago, and I was trying to figure out how to program it from scratch per our professor's instructions. Uh-huh. And we, after 3 months, I figured it out, and then we didn't really ever use it again. So well worth the time.
It was so pointless. I guess the idea of it was to automate like management for the cell cultures, like to feed them.
Yes, it was an automatic pipetter, and you would pull in cell culture here and put in, you know, this over here, and it's supposed to be able to move the actual cultures around in different rotations, but it never really worked right because if someone put it in incorrectly, even the first batch, it would, middle of the night, it would destroy all the cells and break all the glass, and you come in the next morning thinking like, oh, everything's great, and your entire experiment's ruined. So yeah, we didn't really ever use it after that.
Well, and not just that, it like wasn't sterile.
Oh, not at all. No, it was like constantly just fungus everywhere. Terrible.
Yeah, I remember there was always a lot of talk about carbon filters, like that was going to solve every problem. We'll just put some carbon filters in it.
It's like the modern day like graphene, right? It's like going to solve all the problems of the world.
I know, right? Yeah. It's like, no, you're still putting your grubby hands in there every day.
My grubby hands.
Not yours. Okay, so that was one thing that, Dr. Gross, I love you. I wonder if you listen. I love you and I miss you. And it was so fun being in your lab. But like,
right. Yes.
There were literally pieces of tape in front of our research stations where people would put like, Dr. Gross, do not cross this line.
Yes. He would still do it.
Yeah. He would destroy your experiments.
Oh, yeah. He would go and I'd have cultures going and I'd clean it, done everything perfect. And he's like, well, don't worry. I'm going to hold my breath and I'm going to be real quick. As though if he was fast enough that with the lightning speed of his hands, he would be able to manipulate things and then come out sterile. And of course it did. And next morning, a bacterial infection everywhere and throw it all out.
Yeah, he's like, I'll be fast. I don't need gloves.
Yeah. And he just hold his breath. It was ridiculous.
It doesn't work that way.
And I was die laughing, but I'm like, well, all right, yeah. It's your lab.
And meanwhile, over in the clean room, I'm, you know, it takes 20 minutes to scrub in every time. And then I scrub in, I do all this work and I get into my zen zone, right? Where I'm keeping hundreds of cultures alive in the incubation, and I go to open the hood and there's like dirty gloves and like old medium, which is full of sugar, by the way, like what you're feeding these cells, just like sticky and like stuck to the vet. And you're like, oh, it's just like a breeding ground for gross shit to grow. A big chunk of my master's thesis was contamination protocol.
Yes, I remember that. I was there. I sat down, sat in for it.
Yeah. Oh, you came to my defense?
I did. Yeah, I was there.
Oh my gosh. I don't remember it. I've just like completely blacked that out.
Part of your life.
Exactly. And so what I thought was interesting was that I was not a bio undergrad. I was a bio master's. You were a bio undergrad. Biochem?
Biochemistry. Yes.
Biochemistry.
Minor in mathematics.
Biochem with a minor in mathematics. So if at our university, if you wanted a biology degree, you had a forced chem minor. And if you wanted a biochem degree, I guess you could choose your minor.
Right. It was a, because you were taking biochemistry and molecular genetics and all that anyway. So you could choose your minor. And so I chose mathematics and I had plenty of chemistry and all that anyway.
So your undergrad was probably way more difficult than my master's.
I don't know.
My master's was like a build your own degree because it was basically neuroscience, but we didn't have a neuroscience department. We only had neuroscience labs within the bio department. So I was basically taking every neuroscience class I could, but it was still a biology degree.
But we did have enough money for that new athletic complex, which is really important for our university.
It's very important for the Fighting Eagles.
Yeah,
for all those football games.
1-23 record. We never seem to surpass. But
do you ever go to one of those games?
I went to two.
You went to two football games when you were at school there?
I did.
I did not.
And I looked, and the opposing team usually had more fans than we did. So
on
it was
kind of
sad. Yeah, on our campus, yes.
And did you walk when you graduated? Did you put like the cap and gown and do the whole shebang?
I did. I didn't want to. Uh-huh. And then our mutual friend made me.
Uh-huh.
And I just came. So I was kind of...
Wait, who made you? Aaron?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I had like disheveled hair and a white t-shirt and tennis shoes and I looked terrible. But I'd walked.
Did your parents come?
Yeah, they were all there. And that's why they made... Aaron's like, look, it's really important to your family.
Oh, they drove all the way up from Houston.
Yeah, they did.
That's nice.
I mean, it was, it's like nothing personal. I just never thought I would walk. I just, I'm ready to kind of go to New York.
To get the fuck out of here.
Yes.
So that was the interesting thing. So I was doing my master's, you were doing your undergrad, but we were the same age. And that's because before you went to college, you were
I was in the
armed forces.
Yes,
you were
in the
Marine.
That's right.
Yeah. Oh, let's talk about that.
Oh, okay.
Unless you, is this
opening
old wounds?
No. I can talk about it. It's fine.
I forgot that you were a Marine.
Yeah, I was.
Hoorah!
Hoorah.
Oh, fuck.
So you gotta drop the H.
Gotcha.
Otherwise, you're an
Hoorah!
Army. Yeah, there
okay.
you go.
Do you have a Marine tattoo?
I have a generic barbed wire, crown of thorns tattoo that I got in the military in the Marines.
That's so Christian.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
You're like the biggest atheist I know.
Yeah, very Christian. Well, everyone else was getting like bulldogs and USMC, and I thought I'd be different by getting the tribal tat. So.
I love it. So you were in the Marine Corps out of high school?
Right.
What made you choose to enlist?
Let's see how if we want to get more psychological, but I got out essentially, and I applied to many colleges, and I got into a few that I really liked, but the problem was I couldn't afford them, and so I kind of did community college and saving up, but you know, my mom, single mom, three kids, and she had no credit, so loans were like not really having at that time, so I joined the military, and part of it was 9/11, like I was really kind of young and inspired by what happened, like I'm gonna go and you know. Fight for my country, and I have a great respect for people who serve because it is incredibly difficult, and actually I signed up to be intelligence, but then I got convinced to be like an infantry because they told me, you like camping, right? It's just like camping. You'll be sleeping under the stars, and yeah, I thought it was like, yeah, that would be really cool. I'm just going to lay there and look up at the stars every night. And
So wait, when you took your, what's that test called? The ASVAB. ASVAB. So you took that, and I'm assuming you did well.
Yeah, I maxed out the score. I mean,
exactly.
A lot of people
you're,
max
I mean,
out the, yeah.
You're very intelligent. You were a scientist when you decided to go to school. So you got, like, the score that should
a
let
99.
You do anything.
Yeah, yeah. And the problem is I think my recruiter needed infantry.
Yeah.
And they needed infantry signups, and I think the idea was we'd love you to be in, like, a field, you know, a field sergeant and also move up to like officer when you get the time. And they have their own quotas to meet for certain kind of MOSs.
Gotcha.
So
they're
was
like, it's like camping.
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. It was very much like camping with a lot more firing and luckily I didn't get deployed. I was actually injured before that.
Yeah. So tell me about that process. And actually, before we jump into that, sure. You grew up in like not the best neighborhood in Houston, too.
No. We grew up in a pretty rough neighborhood.
And so is this something that you saw? I've talked about this on the show a lot, and I remember seeing it like years ago in which Michael Moore movie was that? Probably Fahrenheit 9/11, where he really talks about the way that young poor kids in the inner city are targeted by recruiters.
Yes, they are. I mean, usually because they don't have a father figure. Mm-hmm. I mean, like my case and almost many people in my neighborhood, a lot of single moms, and you have these recruiters will call you and say, oh, you know, you can be, you can make your parents proud or make your parent proud, but you can make your family proud. Like you get all these benefits and they really sell you. And everyone of course backs you up like, oh wow, you're in the military. That's pretty crazy. You're going to be in the military. That's a lot of respect for you.
And so you had that feeling too, yes. Like from your mom, from your older brother.
My mom, not as much, because I hid it from her for 2 weeks. I signed up and then I told her in the mall and she's like, I don't believe you. And she started walking off, stomping off. And I tried to tell her for like hours and she was like, I don't believe you. And my brother was like, my mom, he's serious. He did it. And she's like, broke down, you know?
Yeah, of course. But, yeah, it must be hard for a mom. Like, it's like, you're so proud, but you're also like, don't be stupid. I don't want to lose you.
And that's what she was worried about. Yeah. And at the time, me and my mom were kind of butting heads. But that was kind of actually helped us bring us together. You know, this being a stressful situation, but I did see that a lot is they make you feel really good about yourself because essentially you have these people probably your whole life, you know, you're kind of looked over, but all of a sudden you're getting respect from people. People look up to you. You're doing something very noble and honorable, and that really makes you feel really good about yourself and patriotic. And then you go in and they tell you, here's the benefits, here's what you can do. You get to go to college. And so that was a big motivator for me. And
also you got to go camping.
Oh, yeah. I got to go camping under the stars with like scorpions on me and snakes. It's cool.
And so basic training for Marines is like hell.
Yeah, it's like 13 weeks and it's not pleasant.
So why is it longer than basic training for like Army, Navy, Air Force?
I think the Marines in part want to maintain that type of hardcore.
Yeah.
There was actually, I think back in the 50s, they were talking about getting rid of the Marine Corps. And the idea was to, because we do have a land armed forces, but
we have plenty.
We have plenty of soldiers and, you know, Navy men and airmen. But the whole issue was like Marines have a certain, they were founded in 1775. So they're actually older than the U.S.
Weird.
Yeah. It was 1775. And essentially, it was kind of like the whole reputation that we have that was kind of said, you know.
You're the toughest. You're the meanest. And basically, every Marine is an infantryman first, right?
Rifleman, yes.
A rifleman. Gotcha. Yes.
So that's part of the 13 weeks is also make sure that people can fill in if need be, is all of a sudden you have on hand people that are malleable. Mm-hmm. They can become riflemen at a moment's notice. And so even people who are doing admin work or still keep up training and firing and everything like that. And the training has to be long because essentially the first half is your basic, you know, you're learning in the Marine Corps code of honor. You're getting kind of burned, so to speak, your push-ups and, you know, learning discipline, stressing you out so you can operate in the field in real war with that stressor in mind. And you don't lose your shit because some people do lose their shit and people freak out. And the second half is when they send you out to the mountains of California. But, well, if you're west of Mississippi, east is Camp Lejeune in Louisiana. But the whole point is, in that second part, you do the more, you're used to stress at this point. Your body's kind of adapted to it. Like, you know how it feels and how to operate in it. And then they put you in more stressful situations, like firing over your head. You have to crawl at night. Ammo can runs, and then you get into the gas chamber as well, which is
oh my gosh, I think I remember you telling me about this.
Yeah, so a lot of people do have panic attacks and breakdowns in that.
Okay, so for people who don't know what this is crazy. What did they do?
So whenever you're in ever since chemical warfare became kind of the norm or possibility, since World War I, what's happened is you have to learn how to operate a gas mask and put it on at a moment's notice in case you're in a chemical warfare situation. However, some people panic, so they have to teach you, okay, you know, keep your mind, your wits about you and learn how to put it on as quickly as possible without panicking. And so they basically take you in this big chamber, and these guys come in that are basically covered head to toe in hazmat-looking suits, and they put this big ball of CS gas, and it's like a crystal, and they light it. And in this, you see this thick plume of greenish smoke come out. Mm-hmm. And you have your gas mask in your hand the whole time. And you have to hold it out in front of you. And as soon as it hits you, it's like a concentrated form of tear gas. It's extremely painful, like 10 to 100 times. I forget how much it is.
Oh, God.
But I remember when I inhaled it, it was almost like a transcendent moment, yeah. transcendental moment, because I'd never experienced like that. And I felt burning, like through my whole nostrils, my body, my sinuses, my lungs were on fire. And you have to hold it out in front of you, and you can't put it on.
Until they give you the go?
Oh, yeah. And so you're constantly trying to like sneak in and put it on in front of your face, and if you do, they come over and they rip it off. They rip it off your face.
Because basically, they put you in a situation that's incredibly painful, but not necessarily dangerous.
Not dangerous as in lethal.
But it feels like you're dying.
Oh, it's incredibly painful. Yeah. I mean, you're like snots come out of your nose. Your entire sinus cavity drains out of your mouth.
And is anybody like dry heaving?
Oh, yeah. I'm dry heaving. And the longer you stand there, you're on the ground, you're coughing. And we had someone in there while we were there. The problem is if you hold it out and you kind of put it on, well, that's a penalty. So everyone has to hold out even longer. And so you have to hold it for a certain count, and everyone has to hold it. Mm-hmm. And if anyone breaks it and puts it on, well, that's it. Everyone has to reset.
Yeah.
And so you kind of get mad at your comrades if you're like, what are you doing? So one guy actually freaked out, and he's a football player, real tall, big guy, kind of a star, mm-hmm. and he just couldn't handle it. He started fighting the drone instructors.
And so meanwhile, all of you were like choking to death, still holding your masks out in front of you. And this guy's getting into like a physical altercation.
Oh, yeah. He tried to escape. He was trying to break through the metal door, slamming his body into it.
And because he was having a full on panic attack.
Oh, yeah. He was terrified. I mean, he was he didn't know how to handle it. And he threw himself repeatedly at the door. They tackled him. He fought back. They had to hold him down because now at this point, they're trying to put the gas mask on him to let him know he's OK. But he's not in the frame of mind to do that.
But meanwhile, none of you get to wear yours.
No, so we're all on the ground at this point. We all are on the ground just looking out. Please stop. Please stop.
Oh, my God.
And they finally get them down, and then they let us out, and it's a lesson learned. Now, the problem is it's a crystal, so it stays on your clothes, and since you're out in the field, you don't change. So everyone, you're walking down like an hour later, and you, or even a day later, and you kind of rub your eyes, and all of a sudden you feel the burning come back as the crystals start searing into your eyeball. So
it's like when you're like chopping peppers and you forget, and they like stick your finger in your eye, and you're like jalapeno.
Yes, exactly.
It's real bad. Habanero, don't do that to me. It's my pepper song. That's insane.
Yeah, it was up there.
And then that's not even the worst of it, because you actually got injured during training, but not during basic training, right?
Right. This is more advanced training.
Okay, so you go through basic, mm-hmm. and you are identified. I'm trying to remember from like stories we told in college. You're identified as somebody who's like a really good shooter.
Right, yeah. So I'm an expert marksman, mm-hmm. and that's mainly because I never fired a weapon before, so I had no bad habits.
Interesting.
Right, and that's what they said, though. You know, luckily you never shot. I never fired like a rifle, and so I didn't have any preconceived notions of like Kentucky windage, where you kind of like eyeball it and shoot according to the wind. Which
it's probably
is
rare in Texas, huh? Most of us, I've shot a shotgun before. Most people growing up in Texas have shot a firearm.
Yeah, I never had. I don't know why. I just never thought about it. Never did it. And I got there and I shot well. And so they offered me essentially a position. They go, you can go to, you know, option of recon, sniper. That was one of the options. The other one was a presidential guard. And they kind of take you into these psychology tests on you, make sure like, hey, you have the option. And you can't have like any drug use. It's almost like a FBI type of background check and criteria. And so I chose sniper school, and that's where I did school of infantry. And I was like there for about a week. And both my feet had shattered.
Yeah. So before we get to this insane injury, which like I think has carried you to this day, why didn't you want to be a presidential guard, or did you fail the background check?
No. I passed it. Actually, I was okay. It's gonna sound bad.
You didn't want to have to throw yourself in front of a bullet?
No, I wouldn't. That's fine. I mean, that was part of the duty. I thought it'd be really boring because I was like, oh, I'm probably going to be standing there all day.
It'd be so boring.
Yeah.
The only time your life would be interesting is if there was an assassination attempt on the president, which is so horrible.
Right. Because
you never want to hope for that.
No, of course not.
Of course not. You want everything to be safe all the time, which means your job is literally standing there looking like a badass.
Right. And those guys go through some crazy training as well.
Isn't that the craziest thing? They probably work out all the time. Mm-hmm. They go to training every day, but their job is really just to stand there.
Yeah, it's all permanent readiness. I mean, they have to be in tip-top, and they're always very observant. They're looking around, and they act in a moment's notice.
So the interesting thing is it's probably actually not that boring. It's probably really stressful.
Oh, exactly.
You're like a squirrel in the forest, like just looking left and right and always looking for the predator.
Right. And that's, I mean, it's one of those things where it doesn't look you're doing much, but you're on constant, it's like you're constantly present, I guess, mm-hmm. would be the best way to say it. So you're constantly in the moment,
you know,
assessing,
like,
threats. And
yeah, you could tell me who every person in the room was, what they're wearing, if they look shifty.
And you also go to work on embassies as well. That's, I think, another option for you.
Yeah.
But I and because I didn't really choose it, I don't know the whole background of it, but that was kind of the gist. Like, oh, look, you know, this is how this works. And then you can also do, you know, sniper training, which is like this.
Is there a difference between a sniper and a sharpshooter?
Yeah, I don't know. Sharpshooters, like a rank you get in the rifle range.
Oh, it's a rank. Okay. Yeah, it's not
like
a position.
Rank may not be that. It's kind of like your level.
I love like, having I it's like, the Google.
It's like marksman, sharpshooter, and then expert, I think.
Gotcha.
Three. Yeah.
Okay. I always thought a sharpshooter was like, a marksman or sharpshooter is a person who's skilled in precision shooting. Okay, yeah. But it's not like a sniper. It's like a different.
Yeah, I've never heard of that term.
Okay. So sniper, when you chose, okay, I think I'm going to train to become a sniper.
Right.
Then you had to go through sniper training. It's a different gun.
Right.
Yeah, it's a whole different thing that you probably don't learn in basic.
No, not at all. I mean, it's a whole different, right? You learn long-range rifles.
Yeah, with the big scope. There's like a second guy who carries it. It's like a whole thing. And so,
and I was even not even like officially in, because what happens, you go through a pre-course, essentially, which is they test you and make sure, like, oh, it's like, if you ever seen Clear and Present Danger, it's like that scene where the guy is, you have to hit, you have instructors looking for you in the grass, and essentially you have to hit a target and bing it like twice without them seeing you. And you have someone walk around the field that's trying to find you, and you have to be, I mean, it's pretty, it's extremely intense. I mean,
it's like the scariest game of capture the flag you can ever.
Oh, it's terrible. Yeah. And if they catch you, I mean, pretty much you're done. And I think they, you know, you get some other tries, but I was actually injured before that. I was
So you didn't leave because of anything other than a really bad injury.
Right, exactly.
And what happened?
So essentially I was carrying, we had, we were going on like a 20 mile hike, and that's just kind of common.
Mm-hmm.
But this was after days of, you know, you're not eating a lot, it was pretty rough. And at the time I was a squad leader for my little squad there. And one of my guys had fallen out, and he just fell out, and he's like, oh, I can't do it. And so I had to carry his equipment in addition to my own equipment.
So that he could keep going.
Right. And that was kind of like, okay, he carries the rifles and I have to carry the rest of the pack and the equipment. Well, with all that weight, it was like 130 pounds on my feet. As I'm walking up, I feel like something kind of popped in my left foot. And I think that's when the tendon probably tore off and fell, collapsed my arch.
Christ.
And I was like, okay, well, that's probably not good. But I kept going, and then I felt my right one pop. But I mean, you push through the pain, and I'm like, so at this point, I'm like, it's probably just tendonitis. You know, you kind of lie to yourself. Well, as I keep going, next few days, I kind of ignore it. Even though it's very, very painful. Well, like fourth day, I tried to stand up and I fell on the ground immediately. Like whatever happened, my feet weren't sending the nerve signals to my brain or whatever had happened. I just remember it was extremely painful. And then all of a sudden it kind of went numb. And then when I woke up that next morning, stood up, I couldn't walk. And they took me to, you know, ER and CT scans, MRIs. And you have, you know, fractures all in your foot. Like
so feet. Basically you had so many little breaks in the small foot bones that your arches fell.
Yeah, and it seemed like the what happened was a stress fracture. It started out as stress fractures, but because I ignored it and kept walking, it just broke more and more, so they became large fractures.
And what do you do? It's not like you can go in and set all of those little bones.
No, what they usually do is what they had to do with me is they give you like a bone growth stimulator and you stay off of it and then you hope for the best. Now, you can get surgeries. However, there's a guy in there that for your arches that had, it was on his 13th surgery that was not successful, and his foot was just carved up.
Yeah.
And I was not looking forward to that. So really you just have to let it rest, and then they try to do the best they can. But after, you know, months and months of me saying there, like, look, this is not going to happen. Even if we kind of get you back up where you need to be, you'll never be able to carry enough weight to kind of be a rifleman, you know?
And so now you're, do you feel residual pain?
No, actually, that's, I did a lot of rehab myself. Mm-hmm. I feel only residual pain if I'm running, like, longer than, like, an hour.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, I feel it kind of get sore. Okay,
only crazy people run longer.
Yeah.
And do you have flat feet now?
Yes, I do. They are now flat.
So they stick out like a duck?
I
feel like
guys
with flat feet always stand with their heels together, but their toes, like, splayed out to the sides.
I don't think I'll walk like that. You have to tell me.
I will tell you.
Now I'm self-conscious about
it.
I'm
going to tell you later when we go to dinner.
Yeah, you have duck feet. Gross. All right.
And so what happened? So basically they're like, your feet are fucked up.
Yeah.
There's nothing we can do about it.
Hey, we give you honorable discharge, but you know, we can't really help you. And it actually kind of broke my heart at the time because I really wanted to stay in.
Sure. You did all the work.
Yeah.
But then you had to go.
Yeah, and my platoon was getting deployed. I wanted to deploy with them at the time.
Where were they going?
I think at the time they were going to, was it still Iraq or, no, Afghanistan at the time. Yeah,
it was right around then.
Yeah.
And so what did you do?
I ended up actually getting out, honorable discharge. I went back home, and I was kind of lost for a while. Like, what do I do now? I'd planned my life kind of around this whole plan of 4 years there and this and that. And
come out. Then I'll go to college once I get my GI and do all that.
Right. And luckily, I still had my GI Bill because I got honorable discharge. And so I applied to UNT and some other places. And I go, UNT has a biochemistry degree, and I was really loving biochemistry. And that's pretty much what I did. And I went and got my biochemistry degree at UNT, and here we are.
I love it. And that's how we met.
Yeah, that's how we met, exactly.
And I didn't ever meet you in class, and I didn't ever meet you in the halls. I only met you in the lab.
Actually, we met one time, but it was weird. It was Ian.
Our mutual friend.
Introduced me to you at a bar. But you're working a whole bunch of papers, and you look really busy. And
I
you
was probably
went,
grading papers. Yeah. I was at a bar grading papers. Yeah. Oh, my God. See, everybody knows what a nerd.
Yeah.
Was that a Cool Beans?
Yeah, that was a Cool Beans. And nice. I go, hey, nice to meet you. And you're like, oh, hey, what's up? And I met you. And then I saw your lab. Like, hey, it's you again. And you're like, hey, I'm Carrie. Nice to meet you. I was like, well, we already met. I made zero impression.
No, it was probably my students and their awful answers.
No, I'm a lame-o, it's fine.
Yeah. Well, also, remember, I don't drink and never did.
No, you did. Yeah, you're busy.
I'm like super lame at the bar, like drinking probably a cherry Coke.
Yeah, that's what you had, a cherry Coke. Yeah. Because Ian said something like, what are you drinking? And you said, like, oh, I'm bringing a cherry Coke. And she's like, oh, yeah, she doesn't drink. I was like, oh, okay, cool.
Yeah, weird.
But you look real busy, and Ian's like, consistent. So he's like, oh, let's get going. You know, I think you were trying to do it. But
I did like Cool Beans, so we would go there a lot because they had dart boards.
Oh, yeah. Remember that? Yeah.
I like playing darts when everybody else is shit.
You play darts now?
No, I haven't in a long time.
Oh.
Do you still play darts?
No, I don't think I ever did.
Oh.
I'll play like once in a while in terms of, someone showed me the proper way to do it, like to make, like I was a badass dart player for like two games.
Yeah.
And then I forgot everything, so now I just throw it wildly.
Just hit the wall.
Yeah,
try not
exactly.
To hit humans.
Yeah, my goal is not to hit somebody, not really win.
Darts is kind of a fun bar game, actually. It's more fun, I think, than, I don't know, like pool or something. Maybe it's just because I'm really bad at pool. Pool is not fun. But I think more bars should have skee ball, because skee ball is the best arcade game ever.
Oh, the one where you like throw the little ball in the holes?
Mm-hmm. Where it rolls up and then it goes up into the little holes.
I remember that. Yeah.
Skee ball's the best. We should go to an arcade tonight.
I know. Dave and Buster's is open, probably.
Probably. But instead, we're going to go get Hot Pot.
Yeah, we're going to go to Hot Pot in Houston.
Oh, my God. I love Hot Pot.
So if y'all have any incredible Hot Pot ideas in Houston, you have to send them.
Totally. If anywhere you live, check out Hot Pot. It's the best meal ever. Also, we already went to Shipley's Donuts. You guys have heard me say multiple times on air how obsessed I am with Shipley's Donuts. Every time I come back to Texas, they didn't have cherry iced, which makes me sad, but we got strawberry iced. Maybe they'll be as good. See, now I want
You want me to eat a donut?
I think I want a donut hole.
One
donut hole. Mike is getting me donut. He's closer, which is why I asked him to. You should also have a donut hole. I'm going to make horrible mouth noises now while I eat this donut.
We're just going to eat close to the mic for no reason.
Oh my God, so good.
We're eating the donut hole now.
I can't tell you guys. Like, Shipley's donuts is ridiculous. Donut holes are huge, so it's like filling up my whole gullet.
Yes.
There's a Shipley's in the airport here. And so I usually like buy donuts and like bring them on the plane, really excited to tell everybody back in LA how good they are. And then by the time I get there, they're all like dry and crusty.
Oh, yeah. No, I love Shipley's.
You have to eat them like right away, though.
Oh, yeah. And you have to be careful because if you go, they'll have like the old donuts stale. That's the worst feeling in the world when you get it all excited and they're like old. You're like, what am I doing?
It's so
I failed somewhere along
it's
the line.
So true. Like, not even worth $1.25.
Yeah.
All right. So we've been talking about donuts for, a few minutes, probably enough donut talk. Shit. Okay, so then we were at the lab together.
Yeah, exactly.
Fast forward. We're in the lab. You're studying biochem. You get your biochem degree.
Right.
And by now, we're like, Texas sucks. It's time to leave Texas. I'm like hot and ready to start a PhD somewhere. You're like, what the fuck? let's move. Yeah. Like, that would be great. So we decide that we're going to be roommates in New York.
Mm-hmm. That's it.
And we go to New York, like, totally blind, and we find an apartment.
I remember that, yeah.
Oh, my God.
That was a unique, that was a nightmare.
Honestly, if you grow up in, like, normal places in the United States where there is enough real estate available and most people don't live in apartments, like, some people live in apartments, but some people live in houses, you don't understand the process of renting an apartment in New York where there's, like, brokers.
Oh, yes.
You remember? And yeah. You have to pay, like, first and last month's rent and a security deposit and a broker's fee, and everything's, like, so much more expensive than it should be.
Even the whole time I was talking to him, I was like, am I getting scammed?
I know. Now? You don't know.
Like, and this guy's just making it up, and I come back, and like, I remember there's no building here.
I'm like, know. Oh, like, crap. Make your deposit, and it was just, like, out to his name.
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't know, dude.
Yeah.
But we ended up finding a pretty baller apartment.
Oh, that was incredible. I mean, it was in Queens, on Queens Boulevard. Mm-hmm. It was right there. I think it was like 70th Street or something
71st,
like that.
71st, yeah. We were at 67th, but 71st was a big stop. And one stop over.
I think we got the best deal for our money that we could probably get. We were searching for quite a while in terms of like trying to find the perfect place that wasn't, you know, crime-ridden or
yeah. I mean, at the time, we got a place that was $2,400 a month, and it was a 2-bed, 2-bath, which was unheard of.
Right. Oh, yeah.
That we would each have our own. Because I was like, listen, I can have a guy roommate. I cannot share a bathroom with you.
Yeah, that's
I'm
fair.
Very sorry.
That's fair. No, I understand. Completely.
And, yeah. So you got the bedroom with the connected bathroom. I got the one with the kind of public, quote unquote, the bathroom that leads out. But I got the one with the bathtub because I'm a lady.
Mm-hmm.
And it was nice. It was like marble. Like, you remember how weirdly marble the apartment was?
I do remember, yes.
And it had a decent-sized kitchen. It had, like, a patio. There's a roof deck. I was like, whoa. And then I hung out with my friends that lived in the Lower East Side, and their apartment was, like, way shittier than ours and cost, like, $1,200 more a month.
Oh, yeah.
And so I was like, oh, we got a good deal. But at the time, I was like, are you out of your fucking mind? I had been living in a 3-bedroom house in Denton for $850 a month.
I remember the house. It was nice.
It was nice.
And to move to a 2-bedroom, 2-bath, it's almost insulting.
Tiny. It was 1,000 square feet, which for some people, they're like, oh my God, that's huge. People who live in the city and know what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah.
But 1,000 square feet for two people can be tight. And that was a big place.
Yeah.
It was a big, inexpensive place. I would always tell people, oh, I have the Queens discount. I mean, we lived in Queens.
Right.
So we were like, but you went into the city every day.
Oh, yeah. I took the R right into the city.
Because you were a personal trainer.
I was a personal trainer.
Yeah.
So, yeah, because we moved up there to do our, you were doing your PhD work. Mm-hmm. I was going to get my master's.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we got there in 2008, mm-hmm. and then the economy collapsed about a month later. As soon as we moved in, I was like, oh, okay, that's no good. So the idea was for me to work for about a year and then apply and get a master, you know, start
and like establish
master's.
Residency, which helps. Yeah.
Yeah. And then none of that was really working. So I go, well,
we stayed for a year.
So I had this like fancy private gym, and I'd been personal training actually at college kind of for free, but you know,
you
just
were my personal
people.
Trainer. That's oh my God. Right. You got me super fit in college. I had a 6-pack. It was awesome.
Yeah.
It was hot.
Mm-hmm.
Ugh. Oh, yeah. Those were the days.
Yep.
Yeah,
you get a
you
lot of comments on this. So.
I remember one time that I was doing, what do you call them? They were like...
Oh, rows.
Rows, but the dumbbell rows. Yeah, mm-hmm. So not like on the machine, but like with the individual dumbbells. And I bit my tongue and my mouth filled up with blood. And I remember I was like, and I had to run to the bathroom. And you were like, did I just make her throw up?
Oh, yeah,
sometimes
very
you kick
common.
My ass hard. Yeah, exactly, but I didn't.
Yeah, it was good. I mean, I did have lots
of blood in my mouth, though.
Yeah, you did. I didn't know that until you came back. I was like, uh-oh. I screwed up somewhere.
But that's better than barfing all over the gym equipment.
Yeah, that's better than, yeah. A lot of people do throw up, and they'll, like, just take off in a dead sprint and go throw up in the bathroom and come back.
You don't want to barf on the weights.
Yeah, it's not
ideal.
Oh,
can you imagine if someone barfed on the weights?
I've seen it. It's gross.
That is really gross.
And they just kind of leave it, and they're like, I'm going to go home now.
I'm pretty sick. I'm just going to leave you to clean this up.
Yeah.
Personal trainer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, not good.
Yeah, enjoy your $25 extra an hour.
Yeah. And that's really what I was being paid.
Yeah.
Even at that.
Because
and,
the gym had to take a cut and everything.
Oh, yeah. And that's, because when at the time I was like studying biochemistry, so I was trying to play all these like, oh, I can do the perfect routine and mm-hmm. build it. So when I got to New York and I was doing the training there, I kind of told the guy what I'd been doing. He really liked my ideas. He goes, yeah, I want to hire you. You know, once you come on board and, you know. Kind of told me it wasn't for me. I was like, okay, this will be a temporary thing until the economy kind of kicks back in. You know, I'm like, oh, this is going to turn around really quick. And a year later, I was still there, and I remember thinking, like, uh-oh, like, nothing's really changing. And at that point, I think we both kind of agreed, like, okay, I'm going to go back to Houston.
And I was like, I'm going to L.A.
Yeah, you're like moving up. Like, I'm going to L.A.
I was like, but we were just miserable in the cold.
Oh, yeah.
Texans transplanting to New York. It was hard. I mean, we were broke. Uh-huh. We did it. We tried it. We didn't love it. And so we both ended up going, moving on from there. But while we were there, I think that we ate a lot of hot pot.
Oh, yeah.
We had a lot of fun. We watched a lot of movies. Mm-hmm. And also, you gave me MRSA.
Oh, did I?
So I did get methicillin resistant staphylococcus aureus.
Oh yes, now I remember.
When I lived in New York, it was fucking gross.
Yeah.
I had a little bump under my armpit, and I was out in LA visiting actually, and I was like, this hurts a little more than I thought. Mm-hmm. I thought it was maybe like razor burn, which is apparently really common when people get MRSA. They'll either think it's a spider bite, or they'll think that it's like razor burn. Because at first it's like it's just a little bump. It's a little bit reddish purple. It doesn't have a head, and it's a little sore, and then it just gets bigger and more sore. And finally, I was like, this really hurts. Like, when I try to close the car door and stuff, it's, like, really sore. And so I went to a dermatologist, and he was like, uh-oh. And so he had, like, lanced it, and they had to, like, test it to see if it was if it was resistant to antibiotics. It totally was. So I ended up doing 3 courses of antibiotics. Like, the first one I was allergic to. The second one made me really sunsick. I just kept having all these problems. I don't remember. It's, like, 3 months of antibiotics.
Yeah, I remember because I had to take them too.
And so I guess the idea was that there's 2 different types of MRSA. There's hospital acquired and like community acquired.
Mm-hmm.
Community acquired is really common in gyms.
It is, yeah. Mm. That was one thing we had to watch out for. And unfortunately, actually, a lot of people there had got it.
It's so gross.
Oh, so disgusting. And the funny thing is, this guy, the owner, was extremely clean. Mm-hmm. He would like spray down everything. He had people constantly wiping down stuff. So it was just one of those fluke things where someone probably didn't wipe something down.
Yeah.
And everyone else kind of used it as a small gym.
And also, how do you know? I mean, a lot of people are populated with staff all the time. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it takes you either having like a blip in your immune system, some sort of cut, some sort of open wound, and it gets in. That's why it's much more common and much more deadly in hospitals, because people have open catheters and IVs and things like that.
And when I was at UNT, I got it, and it was right under my nipple. And they had to lance it. And I remember thinking, like, this is like one of the worst things I'm ever going to feel, and it was.
It's really painful, because they have to stick a needle. Like, they numb it before they lance it. But in order to numb it, they have to stick a needle into your infected...
Yes.
Like, boil, basically.
Right. And they go, oh, it's gonna make an epinephrine type shot where it's gonna close the blood. And I was like, okay. And as soon as they shot it in there, it felt like just fire. And I was like, oh god, like I was tearing up. I'm gonna cry.
So painful. Oh my god, that was horrible, actually.
Yeah, it's way worse than people try to make it like, oh, you just got a little. I'm like, no, it's pretty bad.
It's
pretty nasty.
Well, and MRSA can kill you if you're not careful. I mean, skin and soft tissue. Yeah, if you can kind of treat it while it's still on the surface of your skin, or if it's getting a little bit into your soft tissue, and you treat it really aggressively, you're fine. But if it enters into your lymph, your blood, you can die from that. It's actually quite dangerous. So, not to freak anybody out, but
everyone's like checking for MRSA.
It may not be a
spider. I go to the gym. I have it.
Yeah, I know, right? I was talking about that with Varshana the other day.
Oh, yeah.
You guys remember I had my friend Varshana Gurusamy on, the newly minted doctor. And, of course, she went to college with us, too, so we all hung out.
I'll be hanging out with her when she
comes
down
here. Yeah, she's going to come down to Baylor. And we were talking about how, like, when you first start med school, apparently, as you're reading, like, the ICD and you're doing all of your rounds and stuff, you're like, I have every disease.
Well psychology as well, right? I hear about every time someone's in, you know, so I have this disease, I'm bipolar, I think.
Yeah,
I'm suffering from manic depression, this and that.
I'm borderline, I know it. And it's like, no, wait, you got to read all the diagnostic criteria.
Exactly. Yeah, histrionic, and I'm also narcissistic.
Yeah, all of them.
Yeah, all of them. Continued disorders.
We know some people who are all of those.
Actually, yeah. I was like, well, yeah. It's funny the opposite, because I'm not like that. I'm like, okay, see, the people that should not be diagnosed.
That's true. They never know.
Yeah.
That's unfortunately so true. So you were in New York. I leave to go to LA. You come down to Texas, and we've stayed in touch this whole time. We text periodically. I've seen you a couple times when I've come down to visit in Houston. You haven't come to LA yet, have you?
No, I have not.
Okay, so we got to get you to LA. But in the meantime, obviously life goes on. And that was, what would that have been, 2009?
Mm-hmm.
So I can't do math. That's 7 years ago? Shut up.
That's all, I told you the other day, or yeah, yesterday or whatever. I was like, hey, we've known each other for like a decade now.
Oh my God, you're right. And yep. then I was like, yeah, and we met in college. Like, oh, it's not like we met when we were kids.
A decade out of college.
We're so old. And so, but life goes on. So you come back down to here to Houston and you have this biochemistry degree.
Right.
And, you know, you're thinking, what can I do? I'm trained as a scientist. I used to work as a personal trainer. I don't really want to keep doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And you found an interesting field that I think is a very common route for people with science degrees that we almost never talk about when we do science communication. So tell us like what you do for a living.
Sure. Okay. I can. Well, it's funny you said the personal trainer one because I actually came back down and was a personal trainer.
Oh, you
again.
Were for a while.
Yeah, I was for a while because I came back and actually I found what I love was working with people with injuries. And I worked with people up there and I learned a lot about exercise physiology and, myofascial release. And I was helping people relieve injuries and pain. And they were like, oh, I've never felt this good in years. And that really sparked something within me. So I wanted to continue doing that, at least temporarily. Mm-hmm. So I worked as a personal trainer at a nice, very nice gym. And I was doing mainly exercise rehabilitation. So the physical therapist would kind of pass them off to me. Physical therapy, you know, you go up to, they get you to ADL or activities for daily living usually. Mm-hmm. And now if you're an athlete and you want to continue on forward, insurance is not going to pay for you to be, unless you're like already in the NFL. But if you're trying to run marathons again, they're not going to be, oh yeah, sure. We'll keep paying for physical therapy until you.
So you can run a marathon. Yeah, meanwhile, other people in the physical therapy office are like, fuck off, dude. Yeah. Like, I just want like back to the normal like movement of my knee.
Yeah, exactly. Like, get out of here. Yeah. So they usually would transfer off to me and they'd call me and say, hey, we have something for you. And so that's what I would do. And actually, it was from someone there that I was speaking to. I was kind of telling my background as a scientist.
Yeah.
One of my clients. And
well, and also a Marine.
Oh, and a Marine. And we just kind of told stories. And one day, I had become a little bit disillusioned with corporate America as well, like the corporate environment.
Oh, because you'd been doing these this personal training and like kind of chain gyms and
right.
things like that.
Yeah. And I mean, just before, even before I went to college, I'd worked a little bit in corporate America and for a company. And I was like, is this what it's going to be like the whole time? And I kind of was kind of jaded a little bit. You know, I think we all get jaded at a certain point of that whole, the rat race, quote unquote.
Yeah.
So I ended up coming back, but I trained with him and said, hey, would you, I don't know, I don't want to insult you, but how would you like to come in for a job interview? And it was in a field that, I have a biochemistry degree, but it was actually in oil and gas and in Houston. And I was like, more of a consulting type firm. I was like, well, okay. And I was like, well, I don't know as much about, I know organic chemistry, but I don't know the specifics. He's like, oh, you'll trust me. I know you, you'll learn it. You'll pick it up. It's no problem. And so I went in and interviewed and he called me back. He's like, okay, here's a job offer. Do you want it or not? And I took it. And that's where I'm at now. So I'm pretty much a consultant in oil and gas.
What does that even mean?
Yeah, it's a, it's a vague term.
Yeah. I'm like, I know of it. I know of consulting, and I know that oil and gas are commodities that people run their cars on.
Yeah, and so we do, we run the gamut. It's all the way from, oil and the chemicals that come out of that, ethylene, propylene, the olefins, polyolefins, like plastics and stuff. And we do all the forecasting. So we'll do, what are the prices today, and what were they 10 years ago, and what do we think they're going to be in 30 years, which, of course, no one can predict. But, it's kind of what we do.
So it's more of a financial understanding of the way that oil and gas is fluctuating as a commodity.
Exactly. So I actually had to learn economics on my own because I was like, oh shit, like this stuff's a little bit out of my league. And so I had to learn economics. So I bought tons of books and textbooks and I was reading through them and learning financial analysis and economics at the same time. And oil and gas and ethylene and what this goes into and how this is processed and chemical engineering because a lot of my job was chemical engineering. So I have three books on that I was reading at the same time. And it was actually the very, very stressful the first year trying to catch up to do all this.
And how long have you been doing it now?
3 years.
3 years.
Right.
And so you're a pro.
Yeah, sure.
It's an interesting field, right? Because
this
really is a huge part of the economy, especially in the South, when we think about oil and gas as still being a commodity that's within our own soil. We talk about oil specifically coming often from the Middle East or natural gas coming from the Middle East. But of course, we have reserves here.
Oh, yeah.
But we also know that with our current rate of consumption, we are going to burn through it and we're not going to have enough to support us. And even if we do, we know that there are dire consequences of burning all of those fossil fuels. And so do you find yourself, well, A, you don't work for like ExxonMobil.
No, I don't work for an oil. We have different oil companies that would be our clients.
Yeah.
They'll hire us to do like a job of, hey, should we build a plant over here? Can you look at economics? Does it make sense? So that way 15 years from now, we get like a return on our investment that's, nice to our shareholders and all that.
And so knowing that you have these companies that come to you to try and ask you about how to keep doing what they're doing and knowing how dependent we are on this and also understanding, like being a realist, like knowing that if we just said, let's all stop using oil tomorrow, that like things would crash and burn, that we've got to start thinking about a way to intelligently change our relationship with such an important commodity. How does it feel being in an industry that in a perfect world wouldn't exist?
I mean, it's a...
you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, it's an interesting question.
And I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I feel like I know you. Like, right. And tell me if I'm wrong.
No, you're right. I mean, it's very difficult because the problem with oil is it's not just gasoline. I mean, a lot of plastics are made from oil. Almost all this stuff, polystyrene, EPS. I mean, you have so many different things that are made, polyethylene. I mean, everything you look around this room.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's like the microphone made from an oil derivative. The cables, the lamp. Like, yeah.
It's insane.
And so we rely on it. Right.
Oh, yeah.
And it's funny because we struggle with, this is a common theme, I think, that we come up against on the podcast, but just whenever I'm like shooting the show with my friends, is this push and pull between convenience,
right,
and either, let's say, environmentalism, or you could say between convenience and safety. Like we talk about it a lot,
right,
when it comes to internet safety, you
right
know. And it's like, well, I like the convenience of Google like predicting all of my interests in the days,
yeah.
But at the same time, when you actually start to do the research of like what that means and how much you don't have any privacy, it really starts to fuck with your
especially
head.
Especially modern day data analysis, when they're doing data science and you're doing machine learning and it's getting so advanced so quickly, it's kind of scary what they can predict just from a few bits of data about you.
Yeah, and it's scary how much like basically large corporations can own your profile.
Right.
They and like people are selling you and making money off of your visit so that they can then market to you more directly. But at the same time, along with a lot of those breaches in privacy come major convenience.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, it's kind of the same thing when we talk about non-renewable fuel sources, right? It's
right,
highly convenient to put gas in your car and to be able to drive around. It's highly convenient to be able to drink water out of a plastic bottle. The moral question is a different one. I personally think it's like highly immoral, but I also understand that it's the system that has been built up around us.
Exactly.
It's very hard to swim upstream.
Well, it's like even like, I believe like, you know, the whole thing with certain companies that were doing things with drinking water. Maybe it was Nestle who were in certain African countries. And they were, oh, we're going to boycott this company. And then you learn that, oh, that company pretty much owns this company, which is a subsidiary of this company. So, oh, yeah, and they own all these. So you have to boycott like 90% of the stuff in the store, too.
It is pretty crazy when you look at those webs.
Yeah.
You can look it up online, like how a couple of multinational conglomerates.
Right.
I say a couple. It's more than two, but it's not many. Own most everything.
Yeah, and it's difficult to live with, if you think about it. Like, because I can't, I don't have room to talk, because I consume these things. Like,
yeah.
We buy water bottles.
Yeah.
I mean, we do this. I mean, this laptop made out of plastic.
And like, precious, like these special metals, rare earth metals that are like non-renewable.
From China, yeah.
Exactly, that are non-renewable resource that we're like raping out of the earth. And it's terrible. But at the same time, it's like, how the fuck am I supposed to do my job without my MacBook?
Yeah, I mean,
it's hard. It's a hard position to be in.
Yeah, and you think about what is our true right here as a human being, and what way are we allowed, quote unquote, to use the planet for our own gains? Because, I mean, in a certain extent, you kind of look at it and say, well, the universe is indifferent, right? I mean, and the planet's indifferent. I mean, really, we like to say, like, oh, Mother Earth, but really, if you're a scientist, it's like, no, it's alive in a different way. But if we were to vanish, I mean, life would go on here, and we would just not be part of it anymore, and it would adapt to the new whatever it is.
Yeah.
And a horrible fatalist would be like, well, none of this matters anyway, because, you know, heat death of the universe is going to come and wipes out. Yeah. So we know this shit matters.
Long enough.
And then you
the
have
future.
The existential despair and everything that comes with that.
But I do like the point you're making, and it's one that I don't think we make often enough, which is like when people say, oh, well, we're destroying the earth around us. It's like, yes and no. I mean, that is right. True to an extent, but what we're really doing is we're destroying our ability for the earth to be habitable.
Right. And I think that, yeah, I agree with you. I mean, that's something we should keep in mind because we're really doing more of a disservice for our children's children. If you know, the people that are going to have to deal with the problems aren't going to be us, really, if you think about it. They're going to be generations down the line where they're dealing with some things. And I mean, the hope is, and this is almost like a religious faith, which mm-hmm. is our scientific knowledge and our technical advancement will be enough to offset or we can repair these problems. I mean, that's kind of like sci-fi fantasy.
And you're really, so right. It's almost religious to think that way. It's almost like
the singularity.
People, yeah. Fucking singularity. It's like the people who are like really, truly with all of their hearts believe that like cryonics are going to work out. You know, it's like, we're not there yet with the medicine, but I'm just going to freeze my body because I think one day we'll be able to figure out enough to unfreeze me, cure my disease, and bring me back. And I'm like, A, I think that's a pipe dream. It's like a pseudoscientific pipe dream. And B, would you want to come back to that world?
Yeah, well, exactly.
That's a like an important philosophical question.
Right, yeah. Would you want to come back to where you are, your family and friends are pretty much gone? And, I mean, can you adapt to the new world? And it would be kind of weird. You know, it's almost like you can't imagine what that world would even be like. Mm-mm. I mean, truly.
But we can imagine what it would be like to run out of oil. We can imagine what it would be like to pass, you know, the point of no return when it comes to fossil fuel. Well, we basically
and, you
have
know, it's,
done that already.
Yeah, and the problem is, too, you have these countries that say, hey, you're telling us to hold our emissions. You know what? United States didn't do that the whole time. They were Industrial Revolution. You came through and you were able to pollute all you want, and all of a sudden you want us to stop when you're at the top of your game and you're top dogs. What right do you have to tell us that we can't pollute and we can't
so
go
true.
All out?
And we're not stopping
right,
either. No. I mean, we're just now starting to see a culture that allows for alternative fuel sources and alternative modes of transportation. And even then, it's like a pussy move. You know what I mean?
Oh,
yeah. Especially in a place like Texas.
Oh, yeah. And actually, the oil collapse has hurt renewables more because now it's like, oh, I mean, I think even show there was like a increase in Humvee and, you know, SUV sales right after the oil gas prices fell.
Seriously?
And people were saying, oh, then no, people won't do that. And they go, well, actually, we're seeing that pretty quick.
Of course. People are like, gas is cheap again?
Yeah.
All right, I don't mind getting 9 gallons or 9 miles to the gallon.
And there's also weird, you know, correlation when you have cheap gas prices where people end up driving more. So rather than being more conservative, they drive more. Well, now renewables don't look as good because they can't compete unless they get heavy government subsidies. Mm-hmm. Unless the government's stepping in and paying a lot of money to say, oh, we're going to help you guys out. But like, I believe Solar City, for example, like their subsidy and was kind of, I don't know if it was a deduction subsidy, but they were actually up and they were worried it might get cut and it might be phased out. And that's kind of terrifying. If they get rid of that, it's going to be very, very difficult for those companies. Power generation as well. I mean, think about natural gas, you know, $2 MBTU, $3. That's cheap energy. And it's almost impossible for someone like Solar City or someone who has a renewable to really compete with that low natural gas. When it's higher, you can because you're, oh, well, hey, you know, it's expensive for me to produce, but really I'm just as expensive as this oil or gas guy over here. But now it's collapsed. It's like, I can't compete against these guys.
And it's still not widespread enough that it's driving the price down.
It has to almost be a conscious moral choice on someone to choose. I'm going to pay more money, understanding that, it's not the cheapest option, but it's the most moral one for me to choose a renewable way to go about maybe energy or fuel generation or even like car, you know,
and
electric car.
And that's only if you personally have done the research and the soul searching to be able to make that value judgment. So A, you have to make the value judgment, and then B, you have to consciously look at column A, which is cheaper, and look at column B, which is more expensive, and be like, I choose the more expensive route. That's a lot of boxes to check.
So where do you fall on this in terms of like, how do you, you asked me that question, how do you rationalize using a lot of consumables and then at the same time, like, oh God, I don't want to destroy this planet either.
I know, it's really, really hard. So, I mean, I think we struggle with it. You do what you can, right? Like, I drive an electric car. That's something that I could do, but I also live in Los Angeles where it's easy to drive my electric car and the infrastructure is there. And just the way that the city is designed, you never have to drive in terms of miles very far. So I can, but if I lived in Texas, I don't think I could drive my car. because I remember it would not be uncommon to commute 30, 45 miles way to work.
Oh, right.
Because that's still less than an hour to commute. In LA, an hour commute could be like 7 miles.
Especially in Houston. I mean, we have 500 to 1,000 people moving here a day. Mm-hmm. And what's happening is, you can't get a house near inside the loop. You have to get somewhere away from the freeway, and then you have to commute. So if you're having a family, you're going to want to get a decent-sized house and decent school district. You have to kind of go far away and then drive into town to go to your job. And that's usually many, many people in the office come hour, 45 minutes, something like that away. And
and that's literally 45 miles, 60 miles away.
Right.
And so you have to, A, have a car that can make that mileage, and B, probably you have to have a larger car, especially if you have a family. I can get away with driving basically a bumper car. Because it's me and my tiny dog, what I mean? Like, it's a big deal. I actually like that my car is small because it's, like, easier to park in the city because parking sucks in the fucking city.
Oh, yeah.
But that works for me, right? So that's a decision that I can make as a consumer where I can say, I feel good about this. This is both a moral decision because it's not cheaper to drive electric. It's fucking not. My insurance went up. Everything went up when I drove electric. It's not cheaper. But it's not that expensive, and I could do it. It was a decision I could make. I try to do things like, I talk about this a lot, but like, I'll try to use a reusable water bottle. I try, because I'm addicted to Coca-Cola, to only buy it in cans or glass because they're 100% recyclable. I never buy it in plastic. But then, like, you see this water bottle sitting next to me because I'm on set today.
Right.
And
yes.
It's like, there's plastic bottles. Oh, production is so wasteful. And what do you do when it's right in front of you and it's already been paid for? Or what do you do when you're on a road trip and you need water and you stop by the convenience store and it only comes in plastic bottles?
Right.
It's not enough, I don't think personally, for the individual to be making individual choices that are oftentimes a dichotomy that's a tough one to make. Expensive and maybe slightly more moral, if those are even your morals.
Right.
Which hopefully they are, like saving the planet's a good thing to do.
Yeah.
Or cheaper and having dire consequences like polluting the ocean, contributing to the landfills, contributing to greenhouse gas emissions, but way more affordable. And there's no warning label on the side of the bottle that says if you buy this, you're actually doing a disservice to your planet. We're not constantly reminded. We're reminded by the advertising firms that it's convenient and it's lightweight and it's blah and it's blah. And oh, there's a recycle symbol on it, so I think I can recycle it.
Yeah, and that's even fine for people who may have disposable income to allow to do that. But if you have people even that are lower class, I mean, you're like, oh, it's more expensive, but at the same time, then you have another moral quandary, which is like, well, that's money that could be going to feed my family for actual food. And am I really going to short-term versus long-term effects? Like, I won't even be here, but I do need short-term. I'm responsible for my family's well-being. And if I'm spending all this money on premium electric cars and a Tesla and this and that, even though it's bankrupt me, and I can't, but I can't at the same time, pay for my kids' food.
It's not even an option. And so I think that's when you have to start seeing more municipal and state and federal level regulations that prevent people from making decisions that are detrimental to the planet as a whole. And this is, of course, where all of my super conservative listeners are going to get mad, because it seems like what I'm trying to do is infringe on individual rights. But I'm not talking about things that don't harm the greater good or the society as a
conservative
whole. Listeners? Probably not.
Okay. Oh, wait, do you have some? Okay.
I don't know. Maybe.
That'd be kind of interesting to see
maybe more like libertarian listeners.
Yes. Yeah. And you know what's funny? As libertarianism is extremely popular in engineering. I work with a lot of chemical engineers, and it's that and objectivism, Ayn Rand's objectivism, which is, yes.
It's also very popular in the Tea Party.
Yeah, it's very popular in people who already have good money.
Ayn Rand is really attractive to people who are like born into wealth.
Not so much if you're lower class struggling every day because then you're like, oh shit, this sucks.
Yeah.
If you already have money, because then you kind of relieve yourself of a lot of moral quantity. Like, I don't feel bad about doing this because, hey, I'm supposed to look out for myself anyway, right?
It's terrible.
And you don't really need the overt support of other people.
Yeah, but I mean, I do understand a common, at least libertarian, kind of tenet, which is individual rights, individual sure. liberties. If it doesn't hurt anybody but myself, why should you try to regulate what I'm allowed to do and what decisions that I'm allowed to make? And so this is where I think we do have to start talking about the greater good, because it does hurt more than just you. And that's why even little changes, like, for example, we were just at Shipley's and the lady was like, do you want a plastic bag to like
right,
put
yeah.
your paper bags in to take your donuts?
Yeah,
and we're like,
silly.
We don't need a plastic bag. Now in LA, they couldn't even ask you that because plastic bags are banned.
Oh, yeah,
you
true.
Can't
that's right.
get a single that's use right. plastic bag, which is why you saw me. I was carrying my stuff in my reusable
bag. Well, you know what's
bag.
Interesting is I remember when everyone said you should always use plastic because, like, the paper is destroying the rainforest and the trees. Mm-hmm. And now we've come back and said, oh, you should always get paper because mm-hmm. now paper and plastic's way more worse. I mean, it's almost. It's,
yeah.
It's,
and you should. And both are bad. I mean, it's both yeah, yeah, really yeah. bad. It's like what we should try our best to do is remember what it was like before everything was cheap.
Right.
Because I think what happens is that you don't value any of the right, yes. things that you own when it's so cheap and it's so easy to replace them. And to bring yourself back to a simpler time where you actually value your possessions, where the possessions that you have are the things that you love and the things that you care for. You don't clutter your home with a bunch of useless shit, and you don't treat things like they're so disposable. So you use a reusable bag. Most of them are made from recycled plastic, you know, from like plastic bags that are in the landfill or like old plastic bottles. You use a reusable bag and you literally use it until it's so tattered that you can't use
right.
it anymore. But we're just not used to that. I think there's just been a consumer culture for decades and decades and decades of like new, squeaky, shiny, clean. If it's not brand new, it's not worth having. And so we end up basically throwing things away that are still perfectly good.
Oh, yeah. No, I agree completely with you. I mean, we're just not used to that. We have to cut back. And even when there's no immediate feedback of saying, oh, you did great or it feels good. It's more of a, yeah, I'm saving the planet for something like 100, 200 years from now, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't have a good grasp on it. In fact, people are telling me climate change isn't even real. I mean, this all the stuff we're talking about doesn't even matter. I mean, that's unfortunately a big one is in Texas anyway. I mean,
right.
a lot of climate change deniers, which are saying, you know, no, it's all fake. It's false, no matter how good and solid the science is. You have people that really say it's not real, but however, then you have companies that actually do plan for it. They go, oh, well, here's what's going to happen in our financials and our, you know, looking at a forecast of what happens if, you know, climate change affects these industries and et cetera, et cetera. You have to build that in. But then you have on the flip side, and they'll turn around and say, oh, it's not real though. Don't worry about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, that's
know?
Their outward kind
yes.
of stance. But internally, you're right. That's like they're planning for it.
Yes.
They're contributing to it.
Right.
I mean, that's common.
Right. And I mean, an argument even people will say here, libertarianism, they'll say, well, if we start imposing all these strict environmental rules, we're going to price ourselves out of the market and U.S. won't be competitive anymore because then these other countries that don't, we're in globalization, they don't have to abide by them. So they're going to make their costs are way lower. They're going to produce all the goods. They're going to outcompete us and et cetera, et cetera. And that's.
And it's a tough position to find yourself in. And that actually reminds me of what I was going to say, which is that, like, at a certain point, you do have to draw a line in the sand. Like,
yes.
yeah, it's also cheaper to have slaves.
Exactly.
You know
That's
what I mean? It's
yeah,
like,
right.
yeah, and at a certain point, you have to make a moral stance and say, I know that it's going to cost more to do it this way, but if we don't do it this way, we're on the wrong side of history. And I think that what we are faced with as consumers is a culture that has only grown and grown since the baby boom. So we were raised by parents that lived in a little bit of excess. They lived yeah. in a booming mm-hmm. economy, and they lived at the marketing boom also, you know, the Madison Avenue marketing
right.
boom. And then that all kind of fed down to us. So now we are in the worst depression, or we were in the worst, I should say, recession since the Great Depression. But it's a totally different world. We're globalized. So we weren't mm-hmm. smacked. The same, yes, our unemployment was horrible. And yes, we had people that were kicked out of their houses after the mortgage crisis, but we could still buy cheap shit.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas our grandparents, or maybe if you're not as old as I am, your great grandparents who lived through the Great Depression are very interesting models. If you have grandparents who are still
oh,
alive
yeah.
who lived through the Great Depression, talk to them about saving and reusing.
My great grandmother lived through the Great Depression. Mm-hmm. She still like saves glass bottles she buys and it comes in like pickles, and she'll save that forever. And she has like tons of bottles she mm-hmm. reuses over and over. And if I threw away like a bucket container, she's like a butter container. She's like, what are you doing? I can use that for anything. I mean, I can put screws in there. I mm-hmm. can do this. And she's the most conservative person I know in terms of like not consuming excess, because she's still thinking like at any moment it could all go bad. And then what are you going to do? She was taught that. I mean, growing through it, you have no choice but to be careful on how you're consuming. And for us, we're always told that consuming stimulates the economy. Like if you're not consuming, you're a bad American.
Yep.
If you're not out there buying stuff and in the marketplace and you're not part of the economy, you're bad. You're going to make us slow down. You're going to be another recession. I mean, there's a lot of, it's actually a sense of pride. It's almost like a moral imperative that we get sent to us is, in fact, it's moral to consume. You should.
It is,
it makes
yeah.
America strong.
And we're even taught that like having debt on your credit card is the right thing to do. Like, oh, but you're never going to be able to buy a house if you don't have like...
You need credit.
You need to open up multiple lines of credit. And mm-hmm. the only way to really have good credit is to borrow against your credit. And mm-hmm. it's just crazy the way that we were culturally kind of brainwashed into thinking that having a bank hold your debt over your head and buying more shit than you can afford is how you can show that you are patriotic.
And you know, exactly. And it's hard.
Like I'm sitting here like my mind is being blown as we're talking about it.
And the funny thing is because I see, you know, I hear 20-year-olds and I get to talk to them and when we do recruiting, but we'll have conversation. They'll say, I don't know, like whoever gets credit cards is dumb. How could you not figure that out? I'm like, yeah, we were before internet, really. I mean, no one warned us of this. It was more of you had wisdom from your parents and your grand. And that was what I was told, for example, is, oh, yeah, you definitely need to go to college. You get to take out as many loans as you can. It all pay back. You'll get a perfectly great job as soon as you get out.
Yeah, that's a big problem.
You need to get a credit card. I mean, I was told that you need to get at least 2 credit cards to build your credit up, and you need to spend on them.
I mean, they had banks with those little tent things during, like, fairs at colleges, like giving student credit cards with, like, horrible APRs.
Oh, yes, I remember that.
Get a free T-shirt, and, I mean... super gross, but that's like how we were raised, and it was reinforced and reinforced and reinforced. And I think that we have to be comfortable with the fact that it's going to take us to make that kind of change, because I think the minute that we're empowered by understanding that, quote, the powers that be, not that I'm like a conspiracy theorist, I'm actually mm-hmm. the farthest thing from a conspiracy theorist, but when I say the powers that be, I more mean the financial powers that be mm-hmm. are not trying to help you. They're trying to own your ass because they get a higher rating and they are worth more. A big bank is valued based on how much debt people owe them.
Oh, yeah.
It's not based on how much money they have in assets. It's not based on how much they have if they were to liquefy, because they can't liquefy.
Oh, right. They have usually levered. And I mean,
they don't have enough money that if everybody at any given time wanted to pull all their money out, like they would be insolvent. That's common. But I remember working for a big bank, MBNA, way back in the day. I don't even know if that's still a bank. Mm. Bank of America might have bought them. When I was in college, I got a job as like a telemarketer for them, like trying to lend credit cards. And it paid really well. And it was like, oh, it was a great job. And you learn all about it. And you're like, oh, it's a Fortune 500 company. Oh, yeah, they have so much money. Oh, they don't even have any of that money. The reason they're rated as a Fortune 500 is because they have that much money owed to them by consumers. And banks will buy your debt because it actually makes them richer.
And as you pay off your credit card debt, if you do have credit card debt and you're paying it off, wait until you get around, you know, about half of it or $3,000 left on your debt. You'll see a flood of credit card offers start mm-hmm. coming in. They want to recapture you. They know all these great terms. I remember when I did it years back is right when I got down to a certain level, all of a sudden I got 6 in 1 week of credit card offers. And I was like, oh. And it's funny, my other friend had observed this and said, hey, watch what happens when you get to a certain level. How did it happen to me? And he worked for a bank and goes, this is what's going to happen. And sure enough, I couldn't believe it. But it's all a different company. So I'm even like, there must be just someone monitoring, mm-hmm. a computer entity mm-hmm. that's monitoring like debt. And as soon as you get, oh, this guy's really paying it off. Uh-oh, like we're not careful. He's going to get rid of all his debt and not really owe us anything. Well, let's get him some more credit cards and incentivize him to spend. Like here's great, how you can have all the credit line you want.
Yeah,
on
0%
this
APR for a year and blah, blah, blah. It's like, no, none of that is there for you as a consumer.
No.
It's just crazy. But I do remember, I'll tell you what, the day I paid off my credit cards, oh, fucking burden lifted.
Oh, yeah. I can imagine all these people that have student loan debt that are seriously in debt.
All my friends.
And cannot get a decent job enough to pay it back.
Yeah. I have so many friends with crushing credit card debt, crushing mm-hmm. medical debt, crushing student loan debt. My sister has crushing medical debt. I have a friend who just shopped too much when she was, because she had a great job, but it was in retail and there was just an expectation that you look a certain way and dress a certain way. It's like one of those jobs where you can't afford, when you work at the store, you can't afford to buy the clothes in the store.
Right.
But it's still a rat race to try to look the part. And so crushing debt from that. I have friends who just finished medical school with hundreds of thousands of dollars in credit card debt. What a staggering number. Hundreds of thousands of dollars.
And it's also, I always wonder how much should we fault the person spending that much money versus the person, at what point do we say, look, you're the one that racked up that credit card debt. It's really on you.
It's hard, yeah. At what point is it like, okay.
Or student loans even now. I mean, to be fair, I know it's kind of a recent, we have all the information, but a lot of these people were told, I was, like, it's a guaranteed job if you get out with a degree. And I'm very fortunate that I have a decent job. But a lot of people don't. They have a good degree and they come out and they're like, well, I'm not really getting the job I wanted and I have a master's and I feel like I'm not getting paid what I feel like I'm worth, and wages are stagnant. And how am I going to pay off all this debt? My student loan debt, now they want, grand a month. That means for, 20 years, that means like I can't really get a house. I really can't, start a family as soon as I want.
I can't eat at a nice restaurant.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like I can't have like simple pleasures that I should be able to have now that I've kind of put in all of my work. And I think it's an interesting question. Like, where do you draw the line? Who is fully at fault? Like, mm-hmm. obviously, I talk a lot about personal liberty. I think that it's really important on both sides of the coin, and having a strong sense of financial responsibility is really important. I'm all about education, financial education, because I think that it empowers right. people to be able to take control of their lives from a consumer advocacy perspective. But at the same time, I think that when you look at somebody who is on that more heavily conservative bent, who talks a lot about personal responsibility with like kind of a hard, unwavering edge, I think oftentimes what doesn't make it into the conversation is context.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Is, were they ever in a position where they could have stood on their own 2 feet? Or is this debt perpetuating debt from generation to generation? Or, we talk about, she's a doctor. She just finished med school and she has $250,000 worth of debt. And it's like, is she also going to die in that 250? Because like doctors don't make that much money.
Yeah,
they
make way less than
less
you think.
You
they
think.
Do.
Oh, yeah. It's like you see it a lot. I see it with colleagues of mine who work in TV. People think, oh, you're on TV. You must be rich. I remember when I first said I want to get an electric car. Do you guys have recommendations? It was like Tesla, Tesla, Tesla. And I was like, I don't need to tell you I cannot afford a Tesla. And I literally would get messages from people like, but you're on TV.
Oh, wow.
And it's like you don't realize, right? Because we have this inflated view right. of what people are worth and how much they make. But it's like, no, most people are trying to get by. And
right.
granted, I'm not saying that I'm not lucky and that I don't do well and I don't have a great life. Granted, I don't have kids, so I don't have to put food in anybody else's mouth. Like, that is a personal choice that I will stand by.
Mm-hmm.
It is definitely a way to save money.
Yes.
I will advocate for it every day.
Yeah, me either. So I'm looking in that regard.
I know. I'm like, my dog is way cheaper than a child. But that being said, there are certain things that are beyond the control of the individual, and there are certain things that are harder to control when all the powers that be around you and all of society and culture is shaping you to make those decisions.
And so, perfect example, me and you. When we went to New York, mm-hmm. at first, when I couldn't get a job, I actually had to take out cash balances on my credit card mm-hmm. to help pay the rent at first. Because
those have shit APR.
Oh, it's unbelievable. Like, and it's like a payday loan. I was like, oh, Jesus Christ.
It's like a loan shark.
Yeah, I was like, oh, okay. Well, and it was like something like that. The economy collapsed, and all of a sudden you have to, and if you have a family, I mean, I have to feed my family. I got to put this stuff on credit. I got to get food. I got to pay my rent. I got to pull out money. And that's what I did for 2 months. And luckily I got the job quick enough where I was like, okay, I can hurry and pay it back before the interest destroys me.
Yeah.
But it's something like that can happen in an instant.
Oh, and you can backslide so fast and get in a hole you can't get out of. I mean, I kind of had the same position. I remember talking to my father on the phone once and saying, like, when we were in New York, and saying, okay, so I'm working and I'm teaching like 4 classes and this is how much money I make from teaching. I'm also taking these 3 classes. This is how much my tuition is. I do get a fee waiver for this part of tuition, and I'm getting this stipend because of my fellowships. And it's like, so I made a budget on Excel, and this is like, most people do not go to these great lengths, and I'm writing everything in column A, and these are my expenses in order, and these were not like crazy expenses. Yeah, it's like to eat, this is how much it costs for bus fare, things like that. And I was down like something like $500 every month. Every month, based on my very tight budget, living in New York City, I was going to be down $500. And I remember having that hard conversation with my father and saying, what do I do? And him saying, like, this is the time of your life when you can afford to incur a little bit of debt, because once you're out of graduate school, that's when you are not going to want to be living that way. Like, you're young, you have good credit, like, this is. And so I was literally living $500. So when I first moved to to Texas after that, I had something like $12,000 in credit card debt.
Oh my God, I didn't know that.
I'm sorry, back to California.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it's like, I'm in Texas.
Oh, wait. I go to
New York. We live in New York. I'm living that way, and also like moving fees and stuff. And so when I finally end up in LA, I have a shitload of credit card debt. And so, yeah, it took years to like work these jobs, doing TV jobs, doing little hosting gigs here and there, and like paying off my credit card in chunks and chunks and chunks. And then that day I finally paid it off, it was like,
oh, it's the best feeling in the
best
world.
Best feeling in the world. Like, this huge weight is lifted, but not everybody has the opportunity to ever feel that.
You know, the sad thing is, it's almost surreal when I paid them off, because you're just like, oh, wow. And it's sad, it's so surreal that I have, you know, only student loan debt left. I still do have that. Yeah. Like, wow, okay, I'm still in debt for that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're always in debt, right? Like,
oh, right.
I have my car lease, which I actually paid off in one fell swoop because I sold my Yaris.
Oh, the Yaris.
For, like, cash. To get the electric car. So when I got my electric car lease, like, they give you the lump, how much all 3 years are going to cost, and then you pay, you know, month by month. I just paid off the whole 3 years because I had the cash from the Yaris. But now I have a mortgage.
Oh,
a mortgage
right.
is just another type of debt.
Renovations.
Oh my God, renovations. They're killing me. Everything's killing me. But it's true. It's like, you can't, even people with amazing credit, even people who try to figure out a way to live debt-free, there are just things out there. And the sad thing is, they do help you.
Yeah.
You know,
they do. I mean,
my mortgage helps me be able to be financially independent because my mortgage is insane, because I had all of that debt and paid it off, because I have X number of lines of credit, I have a lower rate.
Right. Exactly.
I do better. Like, what the fuck kind of a system is that?
Yeah. And I wonder, especially with this $1 trillion student loan debt, if you even want to play a selfish card, I mean, it's going to come back and bite us in the ass at some point. I mean, it's going to be down the line where when something happens and something collapses, another bubble, because you can't just, you know, discharge student loan debt and bankruptcy at all. And like you said, like, it always feels like you're always in debt, and how do you escape? And if you want a certain lifestyle that, you know, oh, you have to live like this and this, you have to go on debt. And like, especially in modern day with mortgages, it's very, very difficult now compared to what it was to get a mortgage to get a house.
Oh yeah, our house loan was not cheap, and like, we were in a position to be able to do it. You know what I mean?
Right.
But like, and our APRs are decent, but they're nowhere near what they used to be. But that's because they used to not make sense. Mm-hmm. Used to be people who had no business buying a house.
Yeah,
were buying houses they couldn't afford on crazy low APRs, knowing that either when their arm ran out or when they reached a certain point in the mortgage, that they wouldn't be able to pay and they'd default.
Right. And now I heard it's like, you have to go through so much paperwork. You have to make sure approve of a cash flow, and you have to compare to your debt. It's way stricter nowadays.
It took a long time. Yeah.
Oh, did it?
Took,
okay.
And this was a joint mortgage, and I had multiple inquiries on my credit. And yeah, it's definitely hard. You have to prove a lot in order to get it. I mean, it makes me feel better knowing that my mortgage is likely more secure. Like, I know I can afford my mortgage.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Because
yeah. A, they wouldn't have given it to me if I couldn't. But that used to be the mentality. Well, they wouldn't. The bank wouldn't have given me this loan if I couldn't
afford it.
It was, yeah. And it's like, oh, honey child.
Yeah. But it came back and bit us all in the ass, actually.
Oh, my God. It bit everybody except for those, like, four dudes in the Big Short in the ass. And
that's
I heard the other day that one of the main characters of The Big Short, like, one of the main people who actually made money off of the bubble was a woman, and they didn't feature her in the film.
Oh, really?
So stupid.
Why would they not do that?
I don't know. I love that movie, but that movie didn't pass the Bechdel test at all. There are like no women in it.
Oh, is that the test where it's like a female has to be mentioned, not in a, like, alluding to a male?
Yeah,
or something.
It's like,
like,
a
that.
Female has to have a conversation with another female about something other than a man. And so few movies pass.
So what are some movies that do pass?
Like, a recent movie would be The Martian.
Oh yeah,
right. Because
awesome.
Both of both the commander and one of the women on the ship were female, and so of course they were talking to each other about how to steer a ship, how to get to Mars, things of that nature. Not like, isn't he dreamy?
Mm-hmm.
Which is, it's so sad, actually. Next time you watch a movie, think about the Bechdel test, because you'll be like, you're right. They only ever talk about men. Like, what the fuck? Really, or there will be women that never talk to each other, or there's only one woman in the whole movie, or there are no women in the movie.
It's funny because, like, I guess I don't pay attention to it. I guess
none of us do. I mean, that's another one of those situations that you think about where the system is built up in such a way around you that it's almost impossible to make a good decision. You know what I mean? It's almost like the choices, you have an illusion of choice. The choices around you are to go into debt. You can't own a home without going into debt. It's just not possible.
Right, unless you have crazy cash flow that you're flowing in. But other than that, they're not going to give you a loan. They want to see credit, which means, and I hear people doing this too, they want it. They get a credit card and they build up credit and then they pay it off immediately. But that's the only way I can think to kind of get the amount of credit that you need to get some of these, to live the American dream, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. You have to have proven that you can go into debt and then get out of it.
Yes, exactly what I was trying to say. I was trying to find the words. It's like, how am I?
I know. It's like the only other way is just to stash cash under your mattress until you have enough to just buy something cash.
Yeah, straight up. Which, I mean, if you have money, it wouldn't make sense because then usually the mortgages are so low, like what, 3-4%? I'm not sure what they are nowadays. But then you're like, well, with that cash, I can actually get this mortgage and then invest that cash in something that gives me about 78% interest.
Well, that's what smart people... Well, yeah. I shouldn't say that. That's what rich people do.
Yes.
Because rich people... This is the difference between us and rich people.
Mm-hmm.
Rich people make money off of their money. Did you know that? That's how rich people make money.
Yeah. Capital gains is pretty low tax.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. They put their money in places where they can collect interest on their money.
Well, it's actually interesting because then you have the two sides, Democrats, Republicans. Republicans, I think at some point, someone had said they want to remove the capital tax altogether, as in 0%, which means all that money in capital gains is not taxed at all. And then we have, I think, someone on the left that was saying, oh, we should tax it almost at the exact same rate as income.
Of course we should tax it the same rate as income.
So, okay, I have a question for you then.
Okay, or maybe I don't really understand capital gains.
No. I mean, it's interesting, you know, it's like, well, we want to incentivize people to invest more in the economy and actually own stock and own companies and have a stake in them. Or, I mean, it's not an easy answer. I mean, these are all, of
course.
I just
don't think that you should be incentivizing something that is not within the means of the population to do. So the thing is, if the economy is booming and if individuals are in a financial position where they can be investing, that's a wonderful thing.
Yes, but we need to get them there first.
Exactly. We do need to get them there first. But the last thing that we should be doing, and this is a problem that I see a lot of times, is subsidizing things that aren't going to improve the economy. Like, we see this with big ag. We subsidize corn.
Oh, yeah.
Why the fuck do we do that?
And the whole, even I think the oil and gas industry has a problem with our
huge subsidies.
Forcing ethanol. Yeah. I mean, it's a big argument, of course.
We're just really short-sighted. We make decisions that don't encourage the long-term economic growth of the nation.
You know what makes it difficult? And this is kind of what comes to economics. You know, they talk about information symmetry. You know, when information symmetry is there, you can get a lot. It can help make things more efficient.
Concept.
Essentially, we're both sides. Like, we have a deal going on. You're going to sell me a car.
Mm-hmm.
And now you know it's a piece of shit. You know it's busted valve, it's blah, blah. But you make it look real nice, and I don't know that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's an asymmetric information there.
Yeah.
So I'm going to buy it from you. And in fact, that's why a lot of lemon laws were enacted, because that's what dealers were doing. The problem is, when you have asymmetric information, it causes economic inefficiencies.
Yeah.
And the big issue is, it's hard to find good information because it almost seems like everyone has an agenda and you don't know who to trust. And you're finding, like, you type in something now about whatever and you want to find out about, oh, ethanol in the stream. Well, you have one side that will say, no, we need it for this, this, and this. And you have some other people who say, no, I have the truth, with a capital T. And this is why we should not be putting ethanol in the gas stream. And it's a problem for, especially nowadays. Before, it was hard to get the data, but it's almost like now we have too much data. It's like too much noise. I mean,
yeah, so you can't see the signal because we're being marketed to in such a way that the data is being twisted, that we can we can manipulate statistics to say whatever we need them to say.
And so, who, I don't know if you talk about politics, but who are you going to go for? Are you leaning toward Clinton Sanders. Yeah, and that's kind of where I'm at, is I'm looking at all it's the candidates.
Well,
and
I mean, I think in my heart of hearts, I think I prefer Bernie as a politician. But I think what scares me about Bernie Sanders is the opposite of what scares me about Hillary Clinton, right? Like, Hillary Clinton is awful. She's hawkish. She's she is establishment. She's got just as many ties, like deep-seated ties with industry,
right,
as any other politician. She's not going to do anything for campaign finance reform, which was one of my most, yes, I think, one of the most important things we need to do. Whereas Bernie is revolutionary and he would do that. But I worry about his ability to do anything in any sort of international arena, because I don't know. And maybe I shouldn't. I just feel like Clinton can play the game. It's not why I would ever vote for somebody. So I think I'm answering my question right now. I'm definitely going to vote for Bernie Sanders in the primaries. But Clinton can play the game. She's establishment. So I know she'd be good at being a politician, but I know she'd be status quo. And that scares me. Like, what I liked about Obama when I first canvassed for him and during his whole first presidential election.
Yeah, we were in Philadelphia.
Yeah, it was awesome. What I liked about him was that he was not establishment and it looked like he was going to affect change. Now, we all know that this position of power, like, ultimately does corrupt. And there were certain things that I was really disappointed in our president for doing. Like, he wasn't left enough in trying to please everyone. Mm-hmm. And he also made some decisions that were horrible. Like, he deported more people. He was, like, worse on journalists and the free press. Oh, yeah. And, like, so there's a handful of things that were, like, straight up, like, who is this man? But that being said, I was still more excited about seeing somebody who wanted to affect change. And he did in certain arenas. I just don't think he went far enough. So is Bernie Sanders going to be another Obama and let us down? Maybe. Could Bernie Sanders affect change? Maybe. Is he going to have the foreign policy expertise that he needs to have? I don't know. I mean, you kind of can't fuck up our relations with, like, Israel any more than Obama did, but there are other parts of the world.
It's
that
funny because we're kind of jaded in that he's such an idealist, but now we're like, oh, there's no way he's going to get shit done.
I know. It's terrible.
So sad.
I know.
He's finally, like, a revolutionary that we kind of crave. Mm-hmm. And then when he comes, we're like, oh, God, is he going to do anything? Or is it going to be everyone's going to block him at every turn? Because, I mean, he wants a single payer system.
I know, which
was
is
insane
fucking
to me.
Awesome. Yeah.
When I saw it, I was like, oh, God, this is great. I love it. Like, that's incredible.
I would love a single payer system, hands down. I mean, we talk about debt.
Oh, yeah.
We're, as a nation, we are crippled by medical debt. And you talk to anybody in any other, first world country, where the vast majority of them have either a single payer or some sort of national health service.
Right.
And they look at us and they're like, what the fuck is wrong with you people? You're so backward. Like, what is this scam you have where you're letting the insurance companies make so much money off of you?
Oh, it's a nightmare. I mean, I get a bill. I'm still getting bills for, like, a procedure I had, like, 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. And it's randomly in the mail. I just get, oh, here's another $24. I'm like, how is this legal?
Yeah, it's little things, where they're like, it was an x-ray we just found.
Oh, yeah. Hey, yeah, here's an x-ray I forgot I did. Another $150. And I called them and said, you know, I spoke to them one time. And I go, this doesn't make sense. Like, here's what I paid. And then they go, no, sir, you paid this much. I'm like, well, that means I'm actually owed $200. Oh, well, let me check on that. And they hung up and never contacted
never
me again.
Back. Nope. Exactly. Fuckers. And then I think about it and I'm like, okay, so I have Obamacare. I have Blue Shield, which is actually nonprofit healthcare service, which is good.
Right.
And I probably don't qualify for any subsidies, but they just racked up my rates again or raised my rates again. So I'm gold, which is good. It's the second best tier.
Right.
I was platinum. Can't afford that shit anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm gold now. Starting next month, individual health coverage for me out of pocket, $380 a month.
Oh, God, really? That's nuts.
It's nuts. And so I'm actually, like, this is the first year that I qualified for SAG-AFTRA healthcare through my union. And so I'm actually going to start doing that. And I remember the first time I got the letter, I opened it and it said $400. And I was like, fuck that noise. That's expensive. So I threw it in the trash. And then I realized later, it's $400 a quarter.
Oh,
it's a way better deal. So I'm hopefully going to do that within the next couple months when they open enrollment again. But you think about it, like, how the fuck can normal people afford this? I mean, I can't afford this shit.
No, it's crazy to me. That's $380 a month. That's like a nice car payment.
It's a nice car. My car payment is $199 a month, bitches. $380 is crazy. That's like a Lexus.
Yeah, that's fucking insane. Uh-huh. I'm sorry, but
Shit, I'm eating another donut hole. So you have to talk for the whole next, like, 3 minutes.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I'll ramble on. Mm-hmm. But actually medical industry is a perfect example of asymmetric information. You can go right now and try to figure out how much it would cost for you to get an MRI. Just call around and try to figure it. You can't do it. In fact, I don't know if it was Planet Money or a podcast had mentioned that actually. Ago, you know, we tried to find the price of MRI, and I can't do it for a procedure I was trying to get done. I called three or four people, and they go, "Sir, we can't tell you that. We don't know." I'm like, how do you not know how much it costs? So I can't even shop around. So the basics of economics don't really apply very well here.
And they also don't they don't normalize it. So an MRI in one part of the country can cost $6,000, and an MRI in another part of the country can cost $12,000.
Yeah,
but same fucking care.
And then you have these guys who are now opening up cash, you know, cash only places that are like, oh, you can come get an MRI here, $300. Like, oh, what? Really?
Hilarious.
Oh yeah.
They're like, they just circumvent the insurance companies altogether.
Oh yeah.
So when I was first starting to shop for insurance through the exchanges for Obamacare, I knew, what am I going to use my insurance for the most? Because I'm young, I'm relatively healthy, but I have mental health issues. I take medication and I see a therapist weekly. And this is something that is the reason I need coverage, is because my mental health is very important to me. And so I called three different insurance carriers that were in the exchanges, and I asked them, what is your usual and customary outpatient psychological care.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be a weekly therapy session. Usual and customary is the terminology that they use in the insurance company to say, okay, this is what we think your session should cost.
Mm-hmm.
And so we will pay usually like 80% or 70%, whatever their status is, of what we consider usual and customary. So you look and you see, okay, we pay 70% of usual and customary on therapy. And you go, okay, so I want a comparison shop. So you call and you go, what's your usual and customary? Oh, we won't set that until you take the insurance.
That's insane to me, though.
But you're like, I need to know that in order to choose.
To get my insurance.
Because I know I know that my therapist costs X amount of money. And I'm never going to go off network for him, because I'm not going to move my therapist just because I changed insurance companies. That's insane. So like, I know how much he costs. I need to know what you think he should cost, so I know what you will reimburse me.
Right.
And so now it's like the craziest thing in the world. I pay my shrink, I want to say, like, let's say $100 a week for therapy, like for a normal session, which is actually a very good deal.
Oh, yeah.
I think my insurance company reimburses me something like, let me think. Not even. $19 a session.
Oh, no way. That's it?
I know.
Oh, no.
And I'm like, I'm glad I'm paying $380
a month. How can you expect people who needs to go see a therapist with mental health issues, how are they going to get help?
I know. And when
they're
paying $75 out of pocket every week, are you fucking kidding me? On top of your insurance premiums.
What's like a friend that we know, a mutual friend, that also desperately needs therapy. Mm-hmm. He told me, like, I can't afford it. I'm sorry. Yeah. I know I need it, and I know it would help me greatly. Him and his brother actually has a genetic disposition. But they both need it and they can't afford it at all. And they go, I just can't do it. I mean, I can't afford that. I mean, it's like a car payment for me is, and I need serious help for years. It's not going to be like, oh, a few weeks and I'm good to go.
And now take someone who doesn't have the insight to know they even need it.
Yes.
Or someone who's living on the street, or someone who can't hold down a job. Someone who just recently lost somebody to cancer, or they're going through their own treatment. I mean, it's crazy. It's crippling. It's absolutely crippling. And it's the one thing that I hear all the time from people who I know who are from outside of the U.S. are like, they look in like through the curtains and they're like, you people are crazy. Like, what the fuck is with your jacked up health insurance?
And then you get these people say, oh, well, in Canada, they wait 6 months. I'm like, all right, 6 months and never.
That's true. Yeah, that sounds better than rejected.
Yeah,
rejected,
exactly.
Rejected. And it's also like,
but Canada prioritizes as well. They're smart about it.
Cherry picked data. Somebody who's waiting 6 months is probably waiting 6 months because they can afford to.
Exactly.
If somebody needs something right away, if somebody has a dire, like, because that's the thing too. Treat first, bill later. Like, that's the way they view it. And we do that shit, too. If somebody walks into an ER and they're like,
oh, yeah, you get billed
my hand was cut off. I need it reattached. They're not going to be like, can you pay?
Right.
They're going to reattach your hand, but then you're on the hook for it.
Oh, that bill's
and then they
expensive.
Sell your debt to a debt collector.
Oh, yeah.
And then if you still never pay, your life is ruined. Your credit's destroyed. You can never do anything again. And now we have to pick up the tab as the purchasers of shared insurance.
Exactly.
Fuck.
It's a healthcare is desperate need to reform, and people fight against it. I'm like, you're with me though. Like, you're on the same plans I am. You see how terrible it is. You just told me the other day you paid like $2,000 for your little procedure, and now you like and you get a residual random bills. How can that be legal? It's like if I bought an iPad and then Apple keeps sending me bills every few months, like, hey, man, it's another $100. I'm like, what the fuck is this? Get out of here.
I know, I already paid for
and
this.
And I told, like, you know, I'll tell them, like, I'm not paying. And they're like, oh, we're going to send you off to collect. I'm like, I already paid you like $300. Why do you keep sending me bills?
Send my like $12 to collections and then it turns into like $1,500.
And they're like, well, your insurance didn't reimburse this one portion properly. And I sent it back and they said, I mean, it's a nightmare. I can't imagine being a normal anyone that has other things to do to have to navigate this entire fucking labyrinth of insurance.
And we are two relatively healthy people who maybe periodically have a health issue.
Yes.
We do not have cancer. We do not have ALS. We do not have Parkinson's. Like, what the fuck? And granted, leaps and bounds of improvement with Obamacare, you know, people can get insurance who never could before. People can afford insurance who never could before, but God, it's still so broken. It was like one step in the direction that needs like 30. So for that reason, yeah, I mean, I don't know. Like, I think I'd be voting for Bernie. I mean, I think that he's the most, he touches on the most things that matter to me. You know, I'm not going to vote for Hillary just because she's a woman.
Right. I've heard crazy. People say that,
I
actually.
I do want to see a female president, but like, yeah. I'd rather see Bernie Sanders as president.
I've had friends tell me that, like friends here. They'll say, oh, I'm going to vote just because she's a woman.
Just
I was like,
she's
well,
a woman.
That's
yeah.
a little bit unusual, but.
I think that's what John McCain was hoping when he got Sarah Palin, and then it had the opposite effect. Like,
even she alienated.
Oh, yeah. My mom was going to vote for him. And then, you know, my mom's a Texan. And then she was like, that was an insult to my intelligence. And now I'm voting for Obama. I was like, that's amazing.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Anyway, we've been going for a long time. Oh, I'm hungry. Everybody is like, when are they going to stop talking? You've loved it, you guys. You've loved it. But before we go, I have to close by asking you the same question I ask everybody on the podcast.
Oh, God.
On the spot.
What is it?
You ready?
Uh-huh.
So I asked two questions. The first one is, when you think about the future, what is the thing that like keeps you up the most at night, like that worries you the most? And then on the flip side of that, what are you most hopeful, optimistic about?
I'm going to start with the, I guess, the pessimistic viewpoint. Honestly, it's, I think about the future. And one of the, I guess for me is actually, since I'm in it, is more climate change. And I look at the effects of it and what it could possibly be. And I'm just worried that one day I'm going to see that news report, which is like, oh, it's out of control. It's unstoppable. And before you know it, like coastal cities, you're flooded and these people fall down. And from a personal level, I guess, getting some horrible disease and then it being like, hey, you know, you have like 1 year to live. And I don't know, you being a non-believer, I guess existential despair is actually kind of a real thing to a lot of people. And it's like, how do you deal with death? And I think religion for a lot of people is, oh, and that makes me feel better. I feel okay. The afterlife, and it gives me a sense of peace. But when you don't have that, I mean, it's not necessarily a rosy viewpoint. It's just an indifferent one. From an atheist standpoint, it's, you know, who knows what lies after death? Who knows, will I feel anything? What will it be like? I mean, that's something that keeps me up at night sometimes. And I try to think about it. Yeah. And then the most optimistic, I'm going to have to go with, I am optimistic and I'm hopeful, I guess I should say, that humanity, as we advance further technologically, that we will be able to kind of cross that path where we can undo the damage or at least surpass the limitations here on Earth and make sure we don't destroy ourselves. And I guess that's a kind of ties into my fears that as we advance so far, we're not going to have the wisdom to use the new power that we have. And we either destroy each other, which is kind of people say, oh, there's no such thing as aliens, because they get to a certain point and they destroy each other with their, you know, advancements. And I'm hopeful that we surpass that point, get past it. And we live in a singularity utopia. That's not really, but you know, I'm hoping that we don't destroy ourselves. And I guess that worries me too, of the power that one person can do. If you look, I mean, before it was, you had a rock and a stick. One person can kill one person. Then a gun, one person can kill nine. You know, and a bomb came, and now one person can kill dozens. And then with a nuclear weapon, technically one person can kill, you know, hundreds of thousands of people. And I'm just worried that what's a new weapon that one day we'll develop that's so terrible that someone uses inadvertently, and you know, will we have the wherewithal and the wisdom to surpass those limitations of our kind of personal failings and, you know, and become something greater and actually maybe explore the cosmos, which I would think would be incredible. It's kind of like a child fantasy of mine, but childhood fantasy. But
and we've made such great leaps in exploring the cosmos. There's so much more to do. And at least it's good to see that there is a commitment to continue that, that in even when our culture is distracted by war or consumerism or all of these other things, we don't give enough money to it and we don't give enough attention to it, but at least there's a goal that underlies everything that we should continue to do it. And that makes me hopeful too.
And there's people out there fighting the good fight. And that's always like inspiring to me to see them do that.
For sure.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Mike, thank you so much for spending time with me today. This was a lot of fun.
It was awesome. Yeah. Thank you. My first podcast.
Yeah.
Terry's been popped.
I love it. Yeah. And now we're going to go eat hot pot.
Yep, that's what we're doing.
All right, guys. And thank you for coming back week after week. I'm looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.